Okay, this is talking with Cam Wade on First May 78 at the VLA site in New Mexico. So can you tell me when you first came into contact, at Harvard, with radio astronomy and how that came about?
First real contact was Bart Bock. I returned to Harvard from a little sojourn in the Army in spring, before the spring term of 1952, and was rather brash. Full of ideas and no respect for difficulties, and also being very sick of playing soldier, I was anxious to do something that was solidly civilian. So I buttonholed Bart Bock about seeing if there's something we could do in radio astronomy at Harvard. And he had been thinking along the same line himself, and so he was very receptive. And there were a couple of graduate students there who also had similar interests, named Ishan and Lily. Mm-hmm. And so Bart Bock put together a little group consisting of two graduate students and one undergraduate, I being the latter.
And you were a junior or something like that?
I was a junior. I came back as a junior. Elderly junior. I was then 21 years old, but at least I was draft-proof. And didn't have to worry about looking good to a draft board. Which actually was an advantage over the next few years. And we went down to see Doc Ewan. This was within a year of the time Ewan had found the 21-centimeter line.
Mm-hmm.
And his original receiver was still set up in the original place in the Krupp lab. The horn antenna was still sticking out the window over the one of the entrances to the Krupp lab. And all of the stuff was there, and so Heeshan and Lily and I went down there, and Doc Ewan showed us the equipment, how you set it up, and I was first introduced to Ewan's rather remarkable collection of jargon. I found out there's no such thing as a vacuum tube in that receiver. They're all bottles. And there were terms that sounded rather quaint to me at the time. Setting up the frequency, of course you had to pull various crystals and so on. There was a 10 megacycle reference frequency pipe through the lab. You could tap into it in any room. And there's a set of, as I recall, three crystals. And then by beating these in various combinations, you got the frequencies you needed in the system.
Mm-hmm.
And so Doc began talking about beating these crystals against a rail. Well, I had the idea of smashing against a piece of railroad track, but it turned out that wasn't it. Quite another context. Somewhere I still have quite a set of notes on how you set up that equipment, and some block diagrams, and maybe even some schematics. But it was all very flashed up. But anyway, the three of us learned how to set up Ewan's receiver, which was a very primitive thing. It was all out in breadboard fashion.
Right.
And we had very vague ideas of how we would use it, but it was sitting there unused.
It had been unused since the original discovery, I guess.
I believe it had been, yes. To my knowledge, it had been unused, but it still worked. And Ewan was fond of pointing out that it was certainly a reliable rain gauge. In fact, where the horn came in through the window, went into a bit of an elbow, and then it went straight. It had been set up so it would catch Orion in transit. And the bottom of the waveguide, where it made the bend, there was a cork and a huge jar underneath. So in rainy weather, you just pull the cork, and the rain would come in. Of course, pretty good collision cross-section for raindrops. Nasty collection of water he had there. All right,
you say it had been set up for Orion. I haven't heard that before. I thought they,
I think they set it up
at an immediate angle that they knew would cut somewhere through the Milky Way.
Well, we're going on a long stretch of recollection here, but it is my recollection that he'd set it up to catch the Orion Nebula transit. This would be like, what, -5 degrees
deck?
Yeah. And
I can't quite.
My visual image certainly has that horn pointing at about the right elevation.
Yeah, no, they were near zero. I can't quite. They went through Ophiuchus, I know, in the galactic plane. I can't quite remember what the exact deck was, but that's an interesting point. I'll check on that.
Yeah,
I haven't talked to you yet.
Because I'm just going on my recollection
right
here. And that was 1952, it's now 1978, that's 26 years, one can forget.
But it was not adjustable in any sense, there was one declination. Mm-hmm.
There it was, and you made discoveries at that deck, and that was it. Of course, a big fat beam, and with
hydrogen line, you fill the beam, of course. You didn't really fill it in any one velocity, I suppose, in most parts of the sky.
Let me ask you another question. You mentioned the Croft Laboratory. I've always thought
Croft.
It was Croft. I thought it was the Lyman Laboratory.
It's a complex of buildings. I've always thought of that as Croft. I could be wrong. Doc Ewan did straighten it out on it.
Okay.
But it is my recollection it was the Croft.
Okay.
It could be the Lyman, too. They're all, it's all one complex, and you could walk from one to another without getting wet on a rainy day.
So what were you going to do with this thing? What was the...
Well, that was very vague. The main thing was to get a signal, and we'd figure it out. Well, somewhere along that spring, the receiver disappeared. It turned up in Washington at the Merle Tubes operation, DTM, and nobody in the Harvard Astronomy Department any the wiser until the thing was accomplished. Well, Doc Ewan, of course, was starting his company, Ewan Knight, at that stage, so he eventually offered to provide a receiver, which turned out to be the one that we used for several years, the basic receiver. We modified it, but my thesis and quite a few others came off of that several years later. Well, we waffled around. There was problems getting financial support. We needed an antenna. It was obvious that we weren't going to do any serious science with that thing sticking out of a window there. It was all wrong. And we did need proper equipment. It was really no loss in retrospect to miss out on his original receiver.
Right.
It had done its job, and I believe it never did any great things at DTM either.
So you never did get a signal out of it again? Although
not while I was watching. Right. I don't know if Dave and Ed went down and maybe coaxed something out of it. Yeah. I doubt it. So, let's see. I can recall dates. Things looked so discouraging on the financing that Bach actually got out of it at one stage, and Menzel and Whipple took it over, and they were going to exploit their contacts within the military. This is back when things were sort of free and easy on the military funding research.
Right.
And they, they retained the students, but Bart Bach got out. And I was appalled at one point, and perhaps you're not going to print this, but I'll just record it. Menzel and Whipple took us three students to lunch, and what was it, the Commander Hotel in Cambridge. So then sometime in 52, I forgot just when. And I sat there aghast listening to them discuss how they would set this up so it would look good to the military. And I kept thinking, my God, if we can't do it honestly, why do it?
Mm-hmm.
So it surely has merits, you know. But I was very young and green and idealistic. Still am. But the point is, it came to naught. Bart Bach picked it up again and managed to get money from the anonymous donor, Mrs. Agassiz, of course. We wound up getting a 24-foot antenna from Kennedy. And if my recollection serves, we were erecting that late in 53. Now, you see, a fair bit of time had gone by. In the meantime, Doc Ewan had designed and built the receiver, which we wound up using. And the 24-foot antenna was largely a student effort. We bought the thing, but to make it work, it was student work. And it had a hydraulic drive and right ascension. And it was a real kludge, but it worked.
Mm-hmm.
And the way it really went together, Dave Heeshan and Ed Lilly worked very much on the antenna, getting things aligned and so on. I worked along with Doc Ewan on some of the receiver assembly. I didn't understand what we were doing. I didn't do any design, but at least I put things together. Tom Matthews and Kochu Menon had come into this, and they built the hydraulics that drove the thing. And by early 54, if I recall, we were actually getting 21 centimeter profiles. We had a lot of baseline problems and so on, but that was normal at that stage. This was a scanning radiometer, and it was a kludge. I'll not go into the details, but quite a procedure to get it set up, locked, and then tracking in frequency. And
all of this group was supported simply from the Agassiz money? Or
I don't recall now. You would want to talk to Bart Bach if you could on this.
Yeah. I had talked to him several years ago, but I didn't ask him detailed questions.
You ought to check him on this, because he had to live with it. His recollection would be far more trustworthy than mine. I was an undergraduate still doing courses and didn't live with it and lose sleep over it like he did.
Right.
In fact, I was basically paid to sweep the floor in the place.
That's right, you're still an undergraduate at this stage, huh?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Did you do an undergraduate thesis or anything like that connected to that?
I didn't. It wasn't expected at Harvard, really. You could do it one if you wanted to.
Yeah.
But I didn't. I'm lazy. So, anyway, we got on the air, and certainly in 54, things were running pretty well. I'm having a bit of a question in my mind. I may have been a year wrong. My recollection was late 53 we got that antenna on the air, but it may have been early 53. This sort of thing you can check out.
Yeah, these dates I'll check out. Right?
Yeah. So, let's see, we've got...
Was there an anxiousness amongst the group because you knew the Dutch, for instance, were mapping away at this time?
Yeah, there was some. I didn't feel it myself. Here I was, green undergraduate and all that. But Bart Bock certainly felt it. Competition. There's a lot of pressure. Remember, so many times he said, remember, if you don't do it, somebody else will. And I don't think I have the notebook here. I'm living in my office in Socorro. I ran onto it when I was repacking, moving out here. But anyway, it has a New Yorker cartoon that came out about that time. I cut it out, and this is my thesis notebook. It's a loose-leaf binder. It's Charles Adams' cartoon, showing a couple of headsmen getting suited up in their leather jerkins for the day's work. And axes lying in the background and all that. What I'm saying to the other. Well, the way I look at it, if we don't do it, someone else will. And so I kept that in my notebook as inspiration. It's in Socorro. If you want to see it sometime, I'll show it to you. It seemed so appropriate at the time.
Yeah.
But I found that thing, it carried me right back. Well, anyway, we chugged along. Bart Bock, I remember, was extremely concerned that we were pointing the antenna correctly. And, of course, it was a valid concern. We had a 1.4 degree beam width, as I recall, half power beam width. 24-foot antenna, 21 centimeters, in other words. And, okay, that, by modern standards, can conceal a great deal of grief. At that time, though, Bock was concerned, not without reason, you know, that we're pointing 2 or 3 degrees wrong.
Yeah.
That we never had any real problems, but I think he was spooked by the fact that, unlike any other telescope that he'd ever worked with, there wasn't a guide telescope that you could look through and make sure you're pointed right.
Yeah.
And there were very few radio sources suitable for pointing.
At 21 centimeters,
This is the thing. We wound up doing a great deal with Taurus A at a relatively flat spectrum. And anyway, our pointing was certainly as good as the beam justified.
Yeah.
That never proved to be a problem. We did take care with it, though, because we never had a chance to forget it. Well, Heeshan and Lilly got started fairly early on their thesis projects. And they finished up about November of 54, as I recall. Tom Matthews and Kochu Menon came along next. And they finished up, pretty sure Kochu finished up early in 56. I believe Tom was ahead of him by a few months. Might have been in 55.
That's all right. I've talked to all these
You've talked to them,
so. I would be interested in asking you how it was decided who worked on what. Was Bock more or less sort of divvying up the sky amongst the different grad students?
Well,
or?
Not at all. I think people picked out things that looked interesting to them.
So
he was certainly interested in galactic center, and Lilly was interested in the possible correlation between 21 centimeter and absorption. He went looking for a correlation. He found an anticorrelation.
Mm-hmm.
And a little surprise there, but the field was so new, everything was wide open.
Yeah,
there was no need to have a traffic cop. And it... All right, Kochu worked on the Orion Association.
Mm-hmm.
There was the optical ring, well, he found the radio ring. And I picked my topic by process of evolution. I thought it would be interesting to look at several OB associations, smaller than the Orion thing. I'm going to look at several areas of the sky smaller than Kochu's and see how similar one of these things was to another. Now, Kochu had a big one. He could look at that one area in great detail. Well, I was chugging along, and I guess it's time to pick a thesis, late 56. I decided on this, I was newly married, and I picked out, I believe, four associations that looked good. They're well-placed, you know, and so on. And I decided, well, I might as well have a picture of each of these areas of the sky. So I went down, dug out Harvard patrol camera plates,
right,
more or less centered on each one, went to the doctor and made contact prints. And a very simple thing to do. And my new wife was looking them over and said, did you set a Coke bottle down on this? And I said, no. Now, this was the Orion 2 Association, the Lambda Orionis thing. This is what she's talking about.
This is the ring of nebulosity.
Now, this is a dark ring.
Oh, a dark ring.
Yeah. Well, it shows up here. You can see it.
Oh, yes.
Well, I happen to have a photograph in H-alpha, and that ring fit the nebula beautifully. H-alpha is right in here.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, heck, this looks good. It's about 7 degrees across, so we can get reasonable resolution. So I decided to hell with the other associations and went to work on that one, and that's where I got my thesis.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how we worked in those days. You didn't have to be systematic. You wrote. See, I'm talking like an old-timer.
Right.
I'm not even grandfather yet, but anyway.
Well, it is old time for radio astronomy.
Yeah, it is, as radio astronomy goes, yeah. But anyway, chugged along. I took my first observations late 56 and finished early 57. By this time, we've got the 60-footer on the air, so my thesis was the first one off the 60-foot antenna.
I see.
And I'd started it with the 24, actually.
Were there any particular problems in getting the 60-foot going?
No serious problems. We had a receiver that was supposed to go on the air with it that never did work, so we wound up using the old receiver. That receiver is a multi-channel thing, the one that didn't work, and mm-hmm. it was just a little bit too far ahead of its time. You can get all these channels balanced up, everything matched, go off to lunch and be completely out of whack again.
Was it just a DC thing? Or?
Well, I'm trying to remember now. I think it was DC amplifiers, stacks of filters.
I was just talking with John Murray and others at Radio Physics a few weeks ago, and they were talking about the great difficulties they had with a multi-channel receiver.
Yeah, I later did work with John's a little bit, but it was a darn sight ahead of what.
No, his was an improvement. I'm sorry, his was an improvement. That's right, he was called in because
he had 54 channels or something that actually worked.
Right.
Yeah.
But Kerr and someone else were working on one that was a DC thing that they just never really got working right. And then John came in as a troubleshooter, more or less, and sort of redesigned the whole thing.
I don't recall now what the specs were on that thing. It was, again, a night effort. I remember the day, spring of 56, when we dedicated the 60-foot antenna, though. And Bart Bach was out there.
I've seen the program for that. It was a big occasion.
It was a big occasion, much ballyhooed, and Alan Waterman of NSF was up, and, oh, boy. Well,
so Bach,
there were a lot of empty cabinets there. The panels worked fine. And the control room.
So Bach had been able to get some money out of NSF this time.
Yes, by that time he was getting NSF.
He had an established group that was putting out some results.
That's right. And it was pretty paltry dollars by present standards, but then it made all the difference.
Sure, sure.
Of course, a dollar went a lot farther. This was over 20 years ago now. It doesn't seem like it.
Let me just ask, are you going to have to catch the 4:30 bus?
No, I drove up.
Okay, good. Another general question is, obviously Bach is primarily an optical astronomer, and you were, it seems like all this group were very oriented towards looking at things that were optically interesting. And in your coursework, I think you probably had pretty much of a traditional graduate student astronomy education, is that?
Very much so, yeah.
Which strikes me very much because it's very different from the other radio groups this time who were, in fact, I just finished interviewing Nick Thompson, and he said they, first of all, they didn't have many courses as a research student at all, and if they had them, they were simply to do with radio techniques or with radio astronomy per se.
Well, a well-known early radio astronomer rediscovered the precession of the equinoxes. That's part of the problem.
Right.
You may know the story on that.
So, you mean at Cambridge? Or maybe
I've heard the story come in two versions. One has it that it was Ryle that learned it the hard way. The other one is that it was Mills that learned it the hard way.
No, Mills himself has told me that he did. And
okay, well, I think
heard
that's
about
right.
The Cambridge group, but I can't remember if it was Ryle or Smith, but I have heard about one of them.
Well, it's not surprising when you think about it. The procession is not really public knowledge. Yeah. It's not a fact of daily life.
Well, in fact, when I was working in NRL as a grad student, an X-ray astronomer came in and the same thing happened all over again. Procession, you open his eyes.
What's that? No, the training we had, at least we came out of graduate school knowing the difference between mean and apparent time.
Right.
And a few old traditional
but
things.
But you were
like
getting pretty much the same
useful
education as the more traditional graduate students going on into optical astronomy.
Oh, yeah, that's the same as any other person coming out in astronomy. And it's always been a point with me that radio astronomy is not a separate subject anyway. It's just astronomy. We use a different technique. But it's silly to talk about 100-inch astronomy and 60-inch astronomy. We're still looking at the same universe.
Now, the other side of the coin, though, I'd be interested in your opinion, is that it also seems that the 21 centimeter results in the late 50s, mid 50s, had some faults. Some errors were made. And I'd be interested in your opinion as to how that came about. Was it because the people using the instruments really were not the ones that were building them and understanding them completely? Or just optimism in interpreting bumps?